Okay, so as I said, today we're going to do a light, this is a much lighter topic, just to clear our minds a little bit from the not light topic of Chazaka. And before we start big topics again, which will weigh down our thought processes. Wait, I thought I saw Rami. Oh, there he is. I do see Rami. I just out of my peripheral vision. Hello, Rami. Okay, fine. So what I want to focus on is just this tiny little line in the Gemara where the Gemara says as follows. Let's start from Tanya, right? A few lines out in the middle lines on Yoram Beis. Tanya, Amar Lev Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Lit Talmidav. Yochanan ben Zakkai told his students, Banai, my children, Mao Shamar Katuv, Tzedakah Teraumim Goy, V'chesed Leumim Chatat. What does it mean that Tzedakah raises up the nation, and kindness to the nations is a sin? Right, that seems contradictory. What would that mean? So ne'eneh, so what did he say? Ne'eneh, Rabbi Eliezer, Amar Tzedakah Teraumim Goy, Elu Yisrael. Tzedakah raises up the Jews, the nation, singular, the Jews. Dichtiv umikam cha Yisrael goy echad baretz, because sometimes Jews are referred to just as the nation, the goy. V'chesed le'umim chatat, kol tzaka v'chesed she'umot ovdei kohavim osin chedu lehen. Any kindness, tzaka that the nations of the world do is a sin for them. She'enan osin ela lehitgadel bo. Because they only do it to aggrandize themselves through it. Kemoshna Emar, Dailo Von, Makavini Chokhin Lelo Shmaya, Umatlin Lchaimalka, Uvinoi David Hachi, Umatlin Lchaimalka, Uvinoi. Quoting the pasuk in Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar gives, this is not Daniel. Daniel is what we did last time. Last time we were talking about the second sentence. In Ezra, where tzedakah was given with the intent of saving the lives of the king. So then the Gemara says, I don't understand, is that a problem? Ude'avid hachi lav tzedakah gimurahi, and if you brought tzedakah to save yourself, to save your kids, to help you survive, and that's not good? What's the problem with that? Vatanya, doesn't the bride say that Omer Stella Zelit Staka, if you say this money is going to Zaka Bishil Shechiu B'ni, so that my child shall live, Bishil Shezgel Olam Haba, shall get Olam Haba, raise a tzaddik gamur. You are a perfect tzaddik. So that shows you that ulterior motives is legitimate. So Lokasha kan be Israel kan bovdeko ravim. It depends on whether you're a Jew or not. Okay, that's the sugya I want to analyze. It's a problematic sugya at many levels. Okay, someone tell me, what are the problems we have to deal with in this sugya? Ellie. Okay, good. So you're starting all the way at the end, which is okay. Ostensibly, if ulterior motives undermine the value of a mitzvah, that should be true whether you're Jewish or not Jewish. And if ulterior motives don't undermine the value of a mitzvah, so then it shouldn't matter whether you're Jewish or not Jewish. But saying that ulterior motives undermine the value of non-Jewish mitzvah, but don't undermine the value of Jewish mitzvah, is this sort of weird philosophical, legal, whatever you want to call it, theological construction. That's a little bit weird conceptually. Good. That's one problem we got to explain. Yes, Ronnie. Say it again. According to this one, it makes sense that what? What makes sense?
Why did Noah act with so terrible and put it in the apparently, according to this one,
but maybe they would have given it for the right reasons. I don't know. Right? This is... Okay, what else is problematic here, right? What? Yeah, what about it? Please explain. Thank you. Antignas Yishtocho Kimil Mishimon HaTzadik Hu Ayomer Al Tiyu Ka'avadim HaMishamshin in the Rav Amanat Likabo Prat Evu Ka'avadim HaMishamshin in the Rav Amanat Shalom Likabo Prat or Shalom Amanat Likabo Prat, different Gersa'ot there. Antignas Yishtocho says, do not, right, don't serve God like a servant who does it for reward. Do it like a servant who does it either not on condition to get reward, on condition not to get reward, or in English we might say, don't be like a servant, be like a slave. Right? We might formulate it that way. Right? Or in some of the Mepharshim it's more positive. Don't be like a servant, be like a son. Okay, that's the positive one on it, except the more literal translation would, don't be like a servant, be like a slave. What? Sure. Fine. Don't be an employee, be a volunteer. Sure, if you want to do that. That's a nice, modern, less negative twist. Arye, do you want to give Ishrit at some point this week to Shanabet?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to work out with them because their timetables are nightmares. Okay. Fine. So the question that everyone wants to ask is the bigger question, which is, well, this Gemara, at least for Jews, seems to legitimize doing mitzvot for some sort of tzar, even in this world. So you can't start playing this world, next world, because the Gemara explicitly distinguishes that, Olam Haba or L'Shvei Sheyach Yebini. And the Mishnah Avot tells you that's an illegitimate reason to do mitzvot. Okay, good. Yes, Rami. Yes, and we talked about it extensively when we did this, like, you have Goyim giving staka.
It just seems, like, weird why,
no, it's only if they give it for the wrong reasons. Right? You're giving it for ulterior motives. Giving it... Yes, Jews give it for ulterior motives, that's okay. Non-Jews give it for ulterior motives, it's not okay. But for altruistic reasons, it's fine, according to everyone. Fine, mechuyav, that goes back to the sugya that we talked about before. Okay, so those are the two major questions everyone wants to ask, right, which is, dealing with Avot and dealing with the Jew-non-Jew question, but really, if you want to abstract it, which I think we should here, this sugya forces you to ask the broader question, which is, what is the nature of mitzvot such that altruism is or is not required, expected, undermines the value? So, someone want to pontificate for a minute about the theoretical models of mitzvot that might explain why altruism is important, not important, why ulterior motives are problematic, not problematic. We talked about this a little when we did Staka last time, but let's revert to the overarching philosophical concepts. Yes? I just mean here, I'm going to paper that over. I mean, for the moment, altruism as opposed to ulterior motives, meaning not shiyach yebini, right? Doing it for the sake of the mitzvah, however you want to define that, for the moment. For the moment. We can clarify that, but for the moment, let's say to the exclusion of four ulterior motives. I will, for the moment, be willing to accept for devotion to God or out of the goodness of my heart to help other people is both altruistic for these purposes for now. Say it again? Right, okay, so maybe I should... Let's leave ulterior motives. Let's just contrast it. Al-Manashi Yichya B'ni versus not, right? Meaning for not that, right? I mean, Gemara highlights Al-Manashi Yichya B'ni as one reason you might do a mitzvah. Clearly, not even ulterior, I don't know, instrumentalist? Value, I mean, I don't know, we can come up with other words you want for it. But let's for a moment talk about the broader philosophy that might help us understand the sugya. So, someone tell me, what are the different models of why we do good things that exist in the world of moral philosophy? And you can here tell me moral philosophy in general, you can tell me religious philosophy. I'm okay with all of those. Yes. Give me the name of a... Okay, Rami is giving me a very Balabatish description of what we call... What? Utilitarianism. Thank you. Or, as we talked about last time, utilitarianism, which is itself a subsection of what type of philosophy? Consequentialism. Right? Meaning one type of way of thinking about ethics, about politics, about morality is consequentialist. It's about the results. Right? And again, utilitarianism is a subset of consequentialism. Meaning it's the one in which the result is the most happiness for the most number of people, but you could have whatever consequentialist theory you want. Right? You can come up with whatever consequentialist theory you want. There are other consequentialist theories. But one theory of why good things should be done are to get certain results, whatever they may be. Right? Again, what's another theory of morality? What? It gives you purpose in life. Okay, so how would you characterize that? Okay, so by that you mean virtue ethics, right? Where the point of, right, another theory is virtue ethics, right? Where the point of doing good things is to develop ethical people, right? Develop ethical people, right? We talked about this last time. One of the differences, right, one of the critiques of consequentialism is the moral luck critique, right? Where you might intend to do something good, and it turns out bad. So in a virtue ethic theory, you've become a good person because you didn't see those consequences. In a consequentialist system, what you did is bad, right? And vice versa. You might have meant to, you know, a violent person cuts off somebody's arm, right? And that should be a bad thing. It turns out the person had gangrene and he saved his life, right? So in the consequentialist world, he's morally lucky. It turns out he saved his life. He gets credit for saving his life. In the virtue ethics world, you don't really want to spend time with that person because next time he might cut off the arm of someone who doesn't have gangrene, right? Meaning, right, that's virtue. Good. Kant is famous for introducing what theory of morality? One of the most, probably the most influential modern moral philosopher. Whether you like him or not, everyone is now in conversation with Kant. What? Which is called, right, deontological ethics. Right? The purpose of doing the right thing is doing the right thing for the right reason. And he was a purist, right? As he outlines in what's his central book on morality. The fundamentals of a framework of morals, groundwork for a framework of morals, is translated in different ways, right? Not so long. It's really not so long. I read it in high school. His longer books about other things and metaphysics are much more complicated. Critique of Pure Reason and Practical Reason, all those. Now he's a purist. Right, he's a purist, and in pure deontology, not only is it that the ethics of something are defined by doing the right thing, but he needs pure intent. Right, you have to do it for the right reason. Right, you must do the right act because it's the right thing because it is the right thing. That is how morality is defined. Right, now how you figure out what the right thing, and this is part of his theory, is not only that you need to do the right thing because it's the right thing and for no other reason, but he also thinks that a right act must be autonomously decided, right? We talked about this, autonomos, right? Must be self-legislated, right? You can't do it because someone else told you. Neither heteronomy nor theonomy is legitimate for him. What's the difference? Heteronomy, no, or someone else says so. Right, heteronomy, someone else says so usually. Man, theonomy is when that other that tells you to do it is God. He thinks the only valuable ethical act is autonomy, right? Is autonomous. It's self-legislated. Autonomy. Very good. So obviously Judaism will never accept pure a Kantian autonomous value. That doesn't mean that you can't theoretically say the same thing, but theonomously, right? Meaning that the only value is doing the right thing because God commanded it. That would be a somewhat theonomous version of Kant, which obviously he would be very upset at, but that doesn't mean that we're in Jewish Kantians, right? Meaning Hermann Cohn translated it into Jewish thought, and Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote his dissertation on Hermann Cohn, and halachic man is in many ways a theonomous version of Kantian ethics. If that made any sense to you. No. It's a theonomous version of Kantian theory, okay? Because obviously a religious Jew who believes in the value of theonomy can't believe that something's only valuable if it's autonomous. But you can theoretically say that the only value is keeping the halacha, right? Have you read Halachic Man? And say doing the right thing for the right reason is the only thing that's valuable, just change that. Another way, if you wanted to be Kantian and still Frum, there are other ways to do it, which is to blur the line between soft autonomy and hard autonomy. Do you know the difference between hard and soft autonomy?
So
Moshe Sokol has an excellent article where he notes this, that we can't hold, no Jewish theory holds of hard autonomy in the Kantian sense, meaning it doesn't make sense. Right, we believe that you should do things that God commanded, but you can say that we value soft autonomy, which is getting yourself to the point where you identify with God's will such that you would have autonomously chosen it even if God had not. Meaning that many Jewish philosophers talk about as valuable, soft autonomy, meaning you should strive for a point in life where the Torah becomes part of you to the point where even though you're doing it because God commanded it, you would do it. Even without, because your will, asei ritzoncha, right, ritzono kirtzoncha, make God's will your own will, right? That's a soft autonomy, which again, pure Kantian deontology with its demands of autonomy derived from the categorical imperative is never going to be Jewish. But soft autonomy, or there are ways of bridging the gap a little bit, even though he wouldn't have liked it at all. I mean, he didn't like Judaism very much. He was pretty clear about that. He was very clear about, he thought that Judaism, because of its emphasis on theonomy, was not a moral system, right? And very much like Christianity for that reason. He's very explicit. He has papers about this. This is not like, I'm not saying he was anti-Semitic, right? I have no position on that. But the fact that he didn't like the notion of Jewish law as the basis for morality, that is quite clear. He's very clear about this. Yes, Ellie. You're in the back, so you gotta just scream. Yeah. Wonderful. So Ellie says, wait a second. Aren't there parts of the Torah pre-Sinai where people seem to be doing things autonomously? Right? Isn't that important? The answer is, that's a huge machlokas. That's huge machlokas. What? So, I'm just finishing now Christine Hayes' excellent book on What's Divine About Divine Law. It's a really good book. But several chapters are devoted to this question. It's worth reading, getting your hands on. And she notes, correctly, that first of all, among the non-rabbinic Jews, this was very important because, very quickly, Greeks, right, in Greek philosophy, we've talked about this before, but refresher here. What's the difference between natural law and conventional law in Greek theory, in Greek thought? So natural law, A, is fundamentally true. B, gets its value from the fact that it's self-evident and therefore not legislated, and that it's usually unwritten. Conventional law is written, contingent, right, meaning not always true under all circumstances, and less valuable. It's only there to maintain society and things like that. Early Jews, let's say, were in conversation with the Greek theory. In what way? So, Ellie, in what way were they in conversation? So there were some Jews who were so influenced by Greek thought, people like Philo, that they wanted to believe that the Torah was natural law as understood by the Greeks. The problem is, it is legislated law, and it's written, which violate all the rules of natural law theory. So one of the things that they do is that they follow they make a big deal of the notion that the Avot kept the mitzvah, right? Because then they say, really, the Torah is natural law in the sense that it is derivable from logic alone. Evidence, the Avot did it. And they tried to identify the Torah with natural law. They know that there are distinctions, but as much as possible, they try to do it. And she notes that the Midrashim that go in the direction of saying that the Avot knew the Torah and therefore kept it, all the Torah, without legislation, are going in that direction, right? They're identifying the Torah a bit with natural law in that sense. What? So they're not even saying Gershom HaPeh. They're saying that our Torah, which is written, could have been figured out by the Avot, and therefore they kept it. There are other Midrashim that go in the opposite direction, right? Meaning, she notes, all the way to the other extreme is the Pauline version, right? Is Paul, right? Which is basically, law has to be self-legislated, or has to be self-evident, and not commanded, and therefore the Torah is b'dieved, and therefore the redeemed world doesn't need the law anymore. Right? That's, what? Paul. This is Paul. You know, like the father of Christianity. Right? But she notes that, like, the rabbinic position is much more in the middle, where some rabbis see some level of autonomy and natural law by reading the mitzvah back in the Avot, but some have no interest in saying that the Avot kept the mitzvot, and some say that even if the Avot had it, that's because God commanded it. Right? Like the Sheva Mitzvot are commanded to Adam, right? And therefore they see value in legislation, right? But this is one of the big, you know, million-dollar questions in not just rabbinic thought, in Jewish thought, which was the extent to which we value or need autonomy and self-evident philosophy, and to what extent we're totally okay embracing a fully theonomous model, right, and seeing value in the fact that something's legislated rather than despite the fact that it's legislated. Right, this is a very complicated question. Okay. With all that philosophical background, which I think we did a little bit when we did the Tzedakah the first time, so now let's come back here. So, at first glance, the Mishnah in Avot presents a paradigm which is closer to the Kantian model. Closer. Do it simply because it's right. That is what gives something its value. Now, obviously, the Mishnah will probably diverge from Kant on the autonomy-theonomy model, right? But altruism is important, right? And in virtue ethics, it might also be important, though it's mid-level, right? In virtue ethics, pure intent is important at some level, but not necessarily, because if you do something for the wrong reasons, mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma, which is the other series of statements you have in Chazal that you have to, right, which is even doing something for the wrong reasons, if it's the right thing, will eventually get you to the point where you do it lishma, which for virtue ethicists means do it for the wrong reasons, and eventually it'll become habit. That's exactly how the Rambam understands it, right? That you start off by doing things for the wrong reasons, you eventually get to the right reasons. But the Mishnah in Avot definitely goes more, and let's call it the deontological model. So then you have to deal with our sugya, which is in our sugya, let's leave the non-Jew thing for a minute, okay? Let's just focus on the Jew. Our sugya definitely says that giving tzedakah for the wrong reasons is fine, right? Which is much more consequentialist, or maybe if you wanted to, even virtue ethics, but not really, because it says it's gamur. This is like the ultimate goal. So when you say tzaddik gamur, right, meaning me saying mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma, doing things for the wrong reasons will get you to the right reasons, that can easily be read in a virtue ethics model, which is do it and eventually do it for the right reasons. saying that giving it for the wrong reasons, your tzaddik gamur, at first glance, doesn't even work with virtue. It is basically consequentialist, right? Which is, all I care about is that you give the tzedakah. I really don't care why you do it. And then, obviously, you're going to have to ask, well, why is the difference between Jews and non-Jews? But this is sort of the philosophical way of framing the textual problem that the Mefarshim are dealing with. Okay? So now, someone start giving me answers. Someone start resolving the problem. Give me the, pick an answer, and then tell me how it fits into the framework. Ezra. I saw a hand. Okay. So, yeah, give me an easy one. Give me give me whatever answer you want. I don't care. Good. The Torah has hybrid models. Yes. Sometimes it talks in deontology, sometimes it talks in virtue, sometimes it talks in consequentialism. Great. Now use it to answer our question.
So, the Torah will not deny that if you have netted some positive result, then you can have gone some, method.
But you have to deal with the question of gamur. You give me an answer. I'm not telling you. I want to know what you say. Okay, good. So Rami wants to say the solution is as follows. Let's soften tzaddik gamur. Let's say tzaddik gamur doesn't mean perfect. It means there's nothing wrong with what you did. It's absolutely fine. It's not the best, but it's tzaddik matzvik, right? What you did is totally right. There's no fault in it. It's not the best. Therefore, now flesh it out.
If you earn the title of study so far, then that's not the best person ever. And if you were to then do, do the same deed this time without expecting an having an alternative motive, you would be like studying so more plus.
Okay, good. Now, who says what you just said? I already said who said what you said. The Rambam. Right? The Rambam says what Rami says. The Rambam has a very simple solution. Right? The Rambam says as follows. The Rambam is a virtue ethicist, but he recognizes that one of the ways to develop virtue is mitok shelo lishma ba lishma. Doing it for the wrong reasons until it becomes second nature. And therefore, the Rambam tells you very explicitly in his Hakdamat HaChelek that how does the world work? When you're younger, we tell you to do mitzvah because we're going to give you candy, right? That's what I do with my kids, right? Daven nicely, I give you candy. Later on, we hope we wean you off of that, right? And you do it for bigger things so that God blesses the world, even for Schar and Olam Haba. And eventually, we hope that you get to the point where you do it purely because God said so or because it's the right thing to do, because it's who you are. And therefore, the way you read it is as follows. The Mishnah in Avot is ideal. The Gemara in Bava Batra is telling you process, meaning it's totally legitimate to do a mitzvah for the wrong reason. It's not the ultimate, but it's legitimate. Tzaddik Amur just means it's legitimate. What you did is fine, is good. You're not a chassid, you're not the best, but it's fine. So one way to take this is, as Rami says, is to say there are multiple levels. For the Rambam, adopt a virtue ethics vision where the lower but perfectly legitimate level is to do things for the wrong reason to start getting yourself in that mindset. And the ultimate is tzaddik, right? The ultimate is beyond tzaddik gamur, it's chassid. It's to do it shalom and ala kabal pras. According to that, this is a theory about all mitzvot. And that's how you deal with it. And that's, in fact, how the Rambam seems to deal with this problem. Okay? Very good. That's the Rambam. Very good. Yes. Ezra. Which is? Very good. So this was something we already saw in the Stakas Sugya, is to say a different hybrid model, which is there are different mitzvot in the Torah. Most mitzvot are, let's say, deontological. We want you to do it for the right reasons. But there are certain mitzvot which are mostly, if not entirely, consequentialist, where we care about the result. And staka, as we talked about when you did the sugya staka, is the paradigm. And therefore, most mitzvot, as evidenced by shechicha, by the fact that you get a mitzvah even when you forget it. Right? That's why tzedakah is a good example. Right? Because there's a mitzvah literally called shechicha, where you only get to fulfill the mitzvah if you forget it and then leave it. Right? But you can't do it intentionally. You have to forget it to fulfill the mitzvah, which means that helping the boor at some level is clearly, consequences are part of it. And therefore, it could be that the rest of the Torah cares about pure motives because it's more deontological. But tzedakah is different. Before the Midrash Shmuel, which pre-Rishon already seems to indicate that this might be the case, Rabbeinu Chananel. Because Rabbeinu Chananel has a different girsa, which is, one of his girsaot is tzedakah gemura. It's not tzedakah gemura. It's tzedakah. It's perfect tzedakah. Right? Look at the first verse. Then Chananel says, V'yesh mefarshina reizu tztaka gemura. Maybe all it means is this is perfect tztaka, meaning this is local to tztaka. Every other mitzvah is more demanding in terms of your intent, but tztaka, tztaka is different. And that's what the Midrash Shmuel fleshes out, but seems to already be implicit in Rabbeinu Chananel, which is, shiny mitzvah tztaka, shimacho michuleket mikol shar mitzvot bazeh. Tztaka is different from all their mitzvot. Shebishar mitzvot k'tev lo tenasu et Hashem. Because in other mitzvot, you're not supposed to test God. The Gemara says that by tzedakah, you can test God and say, I'll do this and you reward me. Okay, is that okay, God? Great. V'alei amar David ha-melech, avalav ha-shalom, pazer neten levyonim, v'lochem b'shar kol mitzvot tzerech lavrom, and atzulok ha-lopras. Other mitzvot do it not for reward. V'od by the psachim, kamarei de tzadik amur, v'tzadik mitkerei, chasid lo mitkerei. His second answer is, what I already basically said from the Rambam, which is, maybe you're a tzadik, but you're not a chasid. You're a pure, right? So answer one, tzedakah versus other mitzvot. Answer two is, legitimate versus legitimate plus. Tzadik plus, what Rami calls tzadik plus, he says chasid. So those are the first two answers, right? One is to say legitimate versus super good, right? Or the Rambam would call it on the road to virtue versus reaching virtue. The other is to say tzedakah versus other mitzvot. Tzedakah is consequentialist, other mitzvot are not. They're deontological, and therefore altruism is more important, intent is more important than it is by tzedakah. Okay? Good. Someone give me another answer. What? So a lot of the answers here say that it's stuck in Gemura, but they answer in different ways. Now, if you look at Tosfot, his first answer, he has the gears of not of stuck in Gemura, but Tosfot in a very tzedek gemur. And what is, right? So maybe it just means it's bifin stucka. Okay. His second answer is the Garcin and Hachi raised it Sadi Gamur but Davar Hazeh. Right, so the second answer does Rabbeinu Peretz is you're not a perfect tzaddik, obviously not. But this act you're a tzaddik gamur. What does that mean? The Alpha Gav the Mishame Shamanalikalo Pras Mikomakum but Oto Davar Tzaddik. Yeah. So overall, right, this is another version of what Rami said. You're not the perfect person, but there's nothing wrong with what you did. You gave Staka. It's fine. For this purpose, you're a tzaddik gemur. Now, does he mean that tzedakah is different, so only for this you're a tzaddik, or does he mean tzaddik versus chassid? I don't really know. But he's saying he limits the scope. For this purpose, there's nothing wrong with what you did. Now, right, the Nachlan Moshe, he's more bothered by this because he says, what, you gave tzedakah once, you're a tzaddik gemur? I don't even understand what that means. And again, therefore, he says, tzaddik gemur for this moment, meaning there's nothing wrong with what you did here, right? There are various answers that go in this direction. Okay. But Tosfos final answer, which appears in Tosfos in other places, says, I got another answer. And that is, what's Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz's final answer? Now, so far, actually, you know what? I'm going to hold his answer for a second because it distinguishes Jews and non-Jews. so far, no one has explained Jew versus non-Jew. Right? Right? No one's explained that. We'll get to Tosfot. No one has explained it. Right? The Chafetz Chaim also says, right, it's Staka Gemura versus Tzadik Gemura, and he has this nice thing that maybe the way the Gersa happened was that originally just said Tzadik Gimel. And that's why that can easily be expanded to Tzadik Gemura versus Staka Gemura. Now, of course, it could also be that there was a typo. It's an easy typo to make. Okay, fine. Okay, good. So why don't we go to the last one on this sheet first, and then eventually I'm going to come back to Tosfos. But Ezra really likes the answer of the Gaon Rev Avish Vershiner, who I have no idea that is, some Talmud of the Gra, but I found it last night. Yeah, what does he say? Very good. So let's first say what he says, and then let's categorize it philosophically. He comes up with the following brilliant answer. He says, look, giving tzedakah so that your son will live, that's a terrible thing. But saying you're doing it for that reason is great. And this is how he imagines it. He says, look, Ezra, since he loves this answer, Ezra gets to be the tzedakah giver. He finds a poor person, and the poor person really feels bad, because poor people feel bad, right? Why do I have to rely on tzedakah? I want to, right? I don't want to take your money. I'm stuck. And Ezra says, listen, I'm not doing you a favor, you're doing me a favor. Because I have a sick third cousin twice removed, I don't want any close relative of his to be sick. So some imaginary relative? What? I don't know. If you're comfortable saying it, fine. Ezra will look, he'll look at you and say, you have a kid. Something's fishy here. Okay? But fine. I have a relative that I... whatever it is that is sick, and I want them to get better, and I need to give tzedakah. I need to do something. I said a mishaberach, to bless my relative, and I said I'm not shani etein tzedakah because I want the tzedakah to work. But trust me, you are doing me a favor by taking this money. I need to do this mitzvah. So he says it's not someone who does it for that reason, someone who says it, who uses that as a cover to make the poor person feel better. Because part of giving tzedakah isn't just giving it, it's making the poor person feel comfortable. Now, that's a beautiful answer, but philosophically, what is it getting at? Oh yeah, he is going full deontological, do it for the right reasons. He says the Mishnah Avot essentially is what guides me completely. You need pure intentions. Doing it not for the right reason is terrible. It's just that you're allowed to fake it if that's going to help someone. You can fake doing it for the wrong reasons. That's going to make someone feel better. That's fine. But he's a pure deontologist. Yeah. Fine. Not ideal. I don't know. But he clearly is focusing on saying, no, the Gemara is not in any way legitimating doing something for ulterior motives. Right? Okay. Nobody so far here has explained, though, the difference in Jew and non-Jew. Right? Right? Nobody. Right? So what are you going to do? Right? So far, they've explained tzedakah versus not tzedakah. They've explained ideal versus legitimate. But no one has said Jew versus non-Jew. Right? They've left you hanging. So, you'd have to really bend over backwards. Maybe you'd have to say, right, for the Rambam is a virtue ethicist. He'll say, I don't know, maybe either God, for some weird reason, allows Jews to be slower at reaching virtue than non-Jews. That's weird. Or maybe he never expects the non-Jews to reach virtue, which I don't know why that would be true. Right? I don't know, right? Maybe you could come up with something like, Jews have 613 mitzvot. We can't be expected to always be doing things for the right reasons. Non-Jews only have 7 mitzvot. You know, at least those they should do for the right reason. I don't know, right? But no one really explains themselves, right? I don't have a good answer. I can speculate, but no one explains. The one person, the one shita, who bases his entire answer on understanding the distinction between Jew and non-Jew is Tosfot. And what does Tosfot say? This is the third answer. It's Rabbeinu Tam in Rabbi Ant, what does he say? And Toskadeh, he comes up, right? So what does he say? Yes. He comes up with the following. He says, there's nothing, obviously doing it for ulterior motives is not ideal, but it's passable. If, on the following condition, if you do a mitzvah for an ulterior motive, you give tzedakah because you want your relative to be healthy, and then, God forbid, your relative does not get better, will you regret having performed the mitzvah? He seems to have the following theology. Pure motives is the ideal. Not pure motives where you say, look, I really want to do the mitzvah. I also have ulterior motives. But if it doesn't happen, I'll be sad. But that won't be enough to undermine my appreciation of the mitzvah. That's passable. That's maybe even good. But if I'm so wrapped up in the ulterior motive that if I don't get what I want, then I'm going to regret having performed the mitzvah. Meaning the only value of the mitzvah to me is because I got what I wanted. That's terrible. Right? That's Tosfos. That's Rabbeinu Tam. And Rabbeinu Tam says, so first of all, theologically, what's he saying? He's saying, look, according to him, there's no problem with ulterior motives. You can do things with ulterior motives. As long as you also value the mitzvah. Right? That's how he views it. He says you have to value the mitzvah in and of its own right. Ulterior motives can motivate you, but they can't be so central that the mitzvah doesn't mean anything for you without that, without the fulfillment of your desire. Because then the mitzvah are just a tool. They're just instrumentalists. Right? You're allowed to also have ulterior motives, but it can't just be a tool to get what you want out of God. It can't be that God is your vending machine. Right? That's theologically problematic. How does he understand Jew versus non-Jew? He assumes that Jews, even when they do it, they care about the mitzvah, and he thinks that non-Jews doing it explicitly for ulterior motives, right? Not all non-Jews. But non-Jews doing it for ulterior motives, he assumes, will be doing it purely instrumentally and therefore would regret having done the mitzvah at all if they don't get what they want. Now, what would Tosfos say if you found a non-Jew who gives tzedakah for the right reason, for an ulterior motive, but won't regret having done the mitzvah if he doesn't get what he wants? I have no idea what Tosfos would say. It could be that Tosfos would deny the existence of such a person, but if it happened, would Tosfos deny? Is he just making a generality rather than making a fundamental claim? I don't know. I can't promise you. I have no idea. Okay? Tosfos leaves the room open to saying that if there were such a person, maybe that person will also be good, and maybe it's just a generality. I don't know. I can't promise. Okay? Now, there are other answers. In this post I gave you from mine, I will note that even though Tosfos doesn't make it clear, the Ginat Vradim does make it clear. The Tosfos, in the Shut Ginat Vradim, he says very explicitly that it's not about Jew versus non-Jew. This is just a generality. The real distinction here isn't Jew versus non-Jew. It's people who will regret having performed the mitzvah if they don't get what they want and therefore are treating God like a vending machine, and people who won't. The assumption of Tosfos, of the Gemara, is that more Jews value the mitzvah intrinsically than non-Jews, but it's not a fundamental statement. If you found a non-Jew who valued the mitzvah, even when he didn't get it what he wanted, that would be fine. He would, for him, it's legitimate to give tzedakah for ulterior motives. And you found a Jew who would regret having given tzedakah, then that person would be terrible, right? Meaning it's not really about Jew versus non-Jew. That's what you have in the Ginat Vradim. And the Beit Sha'arim says the same thing, right? That what Tosfos is telling you is the real principle isn't Jew versus non-Jew. It's, are you doing it purely for instrumental reasons or also for ulterior motives? That's the real distinction for Tosfos. The Radbaz is on the group who also says, no, it's tzedakah versus other mitzvot. you know, the Behuda says this as well, the Avatzion, the Alkut Yosef, Minchat Yitzchak. There is a fascinating theory that appears in Emek Halacha, and the Aswan Daraisa seems to say this, who says, no, it's not Stukah versus other mitzvah. This is going back to Eli's point at the beginning. It's not Stukah versus other mitzvah. It's mitzvah ben adam lechavero versus mitzvah ben adam lamako. Mitzvah, and Aswan Daraisa has a whole theory based on this. Interpersonal mitzvah are consequentialist. It's about helping other people. And therefore, intent is less important. But mitzvah ben lamakom, their value comes from the fact that you're doing what God said. And therefore, intent must be pure. Is that what you were getting at before, Ellie? Right, meaning, he suggests the difference is, right? And again, that's maybe stuck as a stand-in, maybe by Ben Adam Lachavero, and then the question of, are you allowed to do it for the intent of helping the other person? Right, we can talk about different intents. But another way of looking at it is that Ben Adam Lachavero are more consequentialist in nature, or maybe virtue and or consequentialist, or at least consequences are more pronounced, and therefore it's legitimate to do it for not pure intent. And Ben Adam Lachavero are not like that. The Aswan Daraisa has a important theory about this, where he says that the reason this is true, he says therefore the following. Let's say you're trying to do a mitzvah and then you're stopped, ba'onis. Right? You were driving to do a mitzvah and then they closed the road so you couldn't get there. Do you get schar? So the Aswan Daraisa says it depends. In neither case will you be punished for being derelict and performing the mitzvah, obviously, because you tried. But by Adam Lamakom, he says, you'll actually get rewarded. Because all that God really cares about is obedience. So if you tried to do his will, and you tried as hard as you could, so he'll give you the schar. But by Adam Lachavero, that's not true. Because at the end of the day, you were driving to help someone, and you were stopped, so you're not a bad person, but you didn't help him. And therefore, you won't be punished, but you can't be rewarded either. The Levush Mordechai is an interesting division, which is, you don't get schar unless you have the purest motives, but it's still a mitzvah for some other purposes, like shluche mitzvah and nizokin, right? That if you're involved in a mitzvah, God protects you in this world, even if you have not pure motives. So, like, there's a value to it, but it's not, you're not going to get schar in olam haba unless it's pure. Now, the Nitziv has this fascinating theory where he basically takes Tosfos and turns it into a lechatchila. And he says as follows. He takes Tosfot and he pushes it farther. And he says as follows. It's not just that you're not going to regret performing the mitzvah. It's that, and I'll put it this way. Much of modern psychology, behavioral psychology, has recognized that people are much less in control with their active intellect at any point. Right? Much of what we do is emotion and intuition, right? So a lot of behavioral psychology has basically made the claim that what's the best way to make sure you do the right thing? Well, no, if you intellectually want to do the right thing, the best way to make sure that emotionally you'll carry through with it is by using your brain to set up situations that will make it easier emotionally to do the right thing. Right? So, for example, easy examples, right? I've talked about this before. I want to save money. So I want to double-side all my source sheets rather than single-side them. Right? Or I want to protect the environment. What's the best way to make sure that you'll actually go through with that? Set the default on your printer to double rather than single. Right? Now if I ask you, is that a moral act? Or, right, let's say you think of environmentalism as a moral act. Right? When I print later, double-sided, just because that's the default, is that a moral act? Of now printing it. So the answer is, maybe not, but I've taken advantage of my own weakness I know that I'm lazy. So once it's set at default double, I will usually do that and save the environment. So the original app, so what did I do? I set up a situation to tap into my emotional weakness to get to the right result. Right? I can do that in morality too. Right? I can do that in morality too. Which is, I know, so let me give you an example now in Stucca. I know that I'm lazy. And I know, not only am I lazy, but it hurts me to give money to Stucca. But I believe it's a good thing. So I'm going to overpower my laziness and my greedy nature, my stingy nature, by doing what? So we'll get to that in a second. But let me give you an easy example before we get to the Gemaras. What do? I know that I am busy and I'm lazy and I'm not always so good at giving staka. So most of my staka, how is it given? Right? Myself, me personally. How is most of my money given to staka? What's called in Israel? Horat keva. What's horat keva? Horat keva in Israel. If you ever make aliyah, you better know this. Horat keva is automatic payment. I enroll myself in automatic payment. That's how I pay my credit card bill. That's how I pay my electric bill. And that's how my staka to the shul building fund is also. And to my kids' schools. Horat keva. A certain amount of money comes out of my account every month. I don't notice it. And therefore, I have overcome my laziness and I've overcome my stinginess. But the staka is being given. So now tell me, is that a moral act? So that's an interesting question. Because I am not actively making the choice anymore. I made the choice once. But I tapped into my own weaknesses and said, I'm going to make sure that I do what I want to do intellectually, but overcome my emotional, right, the things that keep me back emotionally. I would hope that we would all agree that whether or not each of those is a moral act, having set up the system is a moral act, and it is at least praiseworthy that I am now set up the Horat Keva. I could always stop it, but I'm not going to because I'm lazy, right? Right? I'm not going to, right? So I've overcome my stinginess and I've overcome my laziness by making a one-time decision to enroll myself in a Horat Keva for Staka giving. So the Netziv taps into that in a much less sort of systematic way and says, "What you could take Tosfos and push it farther and say, it's not just that it's legitimate to motivate yourself by saying, I'm giving because I want my relatives to get sick. But at some level, recognizing that we're weak, that's a good way of... It's actually a good thing to do. Meaning, let's say you're stingy, but you know that even a slight chance that you're going to make money off of giving staka is enough to overcome your stinginess. So what do you do to make it that you give more staka? You look for staka raffles. You know that there's a 1 in 100,000 chance that you're going to win the $100,000, you know, from the staka raffle. Right? You know you're probably giving the money to Stucca, and you're okay with that. But you know that it'll be just slightly easier for you to part with your $100 if there's a 0.0001 chance that you won't be losing $100 but be gaining $100,000. So Tosfos would say that's legitimate because in the end of the day you won't regret having given Stucca. Then it still says that's a great thing that you looked for the raffle, which help you do what you wanted to do anyways. You gave yourself an excuse, meaning you found intellectually you want to do the mitzvah. Emotionally, you find it difficult. So what did you do? You intellectually found an emotional way to make it easier for you to give a tzaka. The Nitzim says at some level, that's what you're doing when you say, I'm an Ashiyach Yevini. You really want to give tzaka. But you're finding an emotional way to overcome your natural resistance to do what you want to do anyways. But you're having difficult doing, right? In the language of Kahneman and Tversky, right, you're using system one, right? You know Kahneman's system one, system two? If you haven't read Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, go read Thinking Fast and Slow so that you will understand all of behavioral psychology in the world today, okay? Go read it. You must read it, right? But they divide the world into things that are accomplished by System 1 and System 2, right? By the active choosing intellect and by intuition, emotion, right? Without thought, etc. But one of the most important things is to control your emotions and your intuitions, knowing, recognizing your weaknesses. And tapping, but rather than giving into them, tapping into them to do what you want to do from, right, when you think about it consciously. So Nassim says, that's what it means. It's not just that it's legitimate. It's that if you realize that you're having trouble doing staka, so you tap into a different emotional need. In order to motivate yourself and overcome your hesitation, that's great. It's not just legitimate, it's great, because you're doing it. And now you can sort of bring it in line with the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, because what are you saying? I'm not really doing it for the schar. I'm using that motivation of schar to get myself to do what I really want to do. I'm just having an emotional problem right now. I'm at an emotional impasse. So I use schar, right? So there it bridges the gap between Mishnah and Avot and this Gemara. It still may not be the ideal, but it's closer than Tosav. Again, he doesn't deal with the Jew, non-Jew, that you can go with different reasons, but I like that, especially in light of what we know, right, and especially in light of modern psychology and how important these types of things are. Have you really, someone was reading Thinking Fast and Slow. I saw it in the base. What? Oh, yeah, Avi was reading it. You should all read it. It's worth reading. I had one of the rabbis, how are you feeling?
Good.
There's a rabbi in Toronto, I'll end with this, right, Chaim Strachler, he's the rabbi of Shari Shamayim, who for the last, I don't even know how many years, the tshuva drasha he gives every year is just how can we, thanks so much, Shua, is how to incorporate behavioral psychology to help ourselves become the better people that we actually want to. Right? How to use the insights of behavioral psychology to make us do the things that we really think we should be doing but are having trouble doing. Right? And then Nassim is basically saying that's what the sugya is. Right? It's not that I'm really doing it on Menashe Yechiyah B'ni. That's sort of the excuse I give myself to override the emotional hindrance to get to what I really want. It's similar to the Rambam, if you remember, that we saw by Kfiya. Right? Remember the Rambam by Kfiya? That we beat the person to give a get to his wife because deep down he really wants to do the right thing, but it's a much less extreme version of that, right? Which is deep down you want to do the one right thing, you're having a hard time doing it. Okay. So like I said, this is a much lighter sugya, but it's nice to think about the value of mitzvah, what mitzvah are for, what staka is for, do a little bit of psychology, overacting with lumdos and philosophy, and from what I gather tomorrow,